Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to continue to talk about brain chemistry, recapping a little of what I talked about last week, and adding some information about how you change brain chemistry, at least how we are able to dilute, if not delete, the old lessons that our brain learned, and therefore change some of the chemicals that it's dropping into our bloodstream. After that, I'm going to play two reviews of Sharon Leslie's, one of The Imaginary Invalid and another of Visiting Mr. Green. And I'm going to play pieces of interviews with Carolyn Michael, who is in The Invalid, and Howard Millman, who directed Mr. Green, and then a piece of an interview I did with the two of them. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
As I got an email asking me these questions, that it's been a long time since I said anything about who I am and what you can expect from this show. I used to do it on all the shows, and I guess I got a little complacent. I realize now that people are tuning in who have never heard the show before, and the title of the show, The Lynn Show, doesn't really tell you very much about what to expect, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that this morning. Oh, I guess for you it's not morning. Oh, well, it might be morning. It's 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and it's 10 o'clock on the west coast of the United States, and I don't know what time it is over the pond. If you're listening on Tuesday, if you're listening on Monday, then it's at 3 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Anyway, this is The Lynn Show. I am Lynn. I'm a psychotherapist. I've been in practice more than 30 years. Currently, my practice is all on the telephone, so that if you wanted to come into therapy with me, you would have to call me on the telephone or email me and set that up. You can get all the information that you want about me and what I do on my website, which is called thelinshow.com. There's an article on there about phone therapy and also a way to get in touch with me. You click on Contact Me and you can email me and I will receive it. Also, there's information about the book that I wrote, which is called When You Can, You Will. Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. A lot of what I do in this show is talk about why people can't change when they want to. Why we get stuck. What is the obstacle to change? The premise of the book is that although the conventional wisdom tells us that all we have to do is want something and try hard enough, and then we can have it. If you only want it and try hard enough, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And then if you don't succeed, try again and again and again. Well, it's my clinical and also my personal experience that sometimes we really want something and we really try and we can't get it. Something stops us from doing something we want to do, or stops us from stopping something that we would like to no longer do. In the first show of this year, I talked about New Year's resolutions and why they don't work, or why they don't always work, because sometimes they do work. Sometimes wanting and trying is enough, and that's great. If you want something and you really try and you get it, terrific. I never want to discourage anyone from either wanting or trying. The problem is that if you have wanted and you have tried, and still you have not been able to do or stop doing something, there's a really good reason for that. And it is knowing that reason, discovering the reason, the obstacle, that begins to put you in the ballpark of the possibility of change. So that's what the book is about, and I talk about that in the first half of most of my shows. The second half of the show I dedicate to interviews with artists. It's a series called Anatomy of an Artist, and I interview people who either make their living or their life with their art. And I ask them primarily how that happened, how they became who they are. In a way, it's not that different than what I talk about in the first half of the show, about becoming who we most want to be, who is our most satisfying self. Every once in a while, I will play some music from a CD that I created. If you were listening at the beginning of the show and the end of the show, you'll hear songs from my CD. And if I interview a musician, I, as often as possible, play things from their work. I get CDs from them and play pieces of their work. Recently, I've begun to air theater reviews by Sharon Leslie, who is a everything. Sharon is an actor, a director, a writer, a performer. She sings, she acts, she makes the costumes. She's written operas and musicals. There isn't anything about the theater that Sharon doesn't know. And in today's show, I'm airing two reviews that Sharon did for plays appearing at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota. I'm airing the two reviews today because both of these plays, The Imaginary Invalid and Visiting Mr. Green, are only running until March 1st. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to run out and see them. Luckily for me, many months ago, I did an interview with Carolyn Michael, who appears in The Imaginary Invalid, and with her husband, Howard Millman, who directed Visiting Mr. Green, and an interview with the couple. And I'm playing pieces of those interviews interspersed with the reviews. And you will hear Carolyn saying, "Death is easy, comedy is hard." And of course, in The Imaginary Invalid, she's playing high comedy. And you will hear Howard talk about directing Visiting Mr. Green and how often he's done it and how important a play it is to him. So that's what's coming up later in the show. With as much time as I have left myself before I play the reviews and the interviews, I'm going to continue to talk about brain chemistry, and particularly in this show, give an example of how neurons firing in the brain alter what we might normally think about what's actually happening to us. And if there's time, I'll talk some more about changing brain chemistry. If not, I'll pick that up next week. So now I'm going to talk about brain chemistry and then reviews and interviews. So, as I have said in all of the last couple of weeks when I've been talking about brain chemistry and how it impacts our life and what we do, if you had a powerful experience early in your life, or a traumatic experience, an intense experience, or you had the same experience over time, your brain learned that that stimulus, whatever it was, requires the response, whatever it made. And I've given the example before, if you were bitten by a dog, and of course that would scare and hurt you, that your brain very likely learned that dog requires an avoidance response, probably an apprehension or fear response. So it is entirely possible that as a grown-up, you are anything from mildly anxious or uncomfortable to really frightened in the presence of dogs, and it doesn't actually matter whether that dog is dangerous to you or not. And of course, Pavlov proved this to us when he taught his dogs to expect food when a bell was rung. Every time he rang the bell, he put the food out. And so they began to salivate as they heard the bell. And then the bell would ring and there would be no food, but they would salivate anyway because their brain had learned that the bell meant food, and it sent the information to their mouth and their stomach to get ready for it, and the dogs behaved as though they were going to be fed. Well, this is equally true for us in so many, many, many ways. And so many of the lessons that we learned, which were appropriate at the time, for example, being hurt by and afraid of the dog that bit you is appropriate. But then later in life, when we might be enjoying the presence of a dog, we are unable to because our brain is telling us something which is not currently true. I'm going to tell you a story from my own life, which my clients have dubbed my strobe light story. When I was a small child, 5 or 6, my dad had I want to call it a motion picture camera. That's, of course, what it was, but I'm sure that's not what they call it today. And he also had a projector and a screen. And he would set the screen up in the living room, and he would play cartoons. You know, he would put cartoons in the projector and play them for me and my infant sister. And then he would take pictures, and he would play them as well. Well, we also had an early television, and they were very, very small and black and white and very dark. And I guess it amused him to take a moving picture of a woman doing a commercial. And then he showed it in the living room on the screen. And it was this postage size picture of this woman sitting on a chair holding a product. It was very, very dark. And it scared me. And talking about it now and remembering it, I can feel that little frisson in my stomach that tells me that I've had a apprehension chemical dropped into my bloodstream. My aunt was in the room. I remember the room incredibly clearly. And she said, "Oh, don't be afraid. It's nothing. Go up and touch it." Well, of course, that was the last thing in the world I wanted to do. So fast forward 20 years, and I'm in a disco in Manhattan. And there are strobe lights. And everybody's dancing and having a good time as strobe lights are going on and off. And I am very frightened. Now, there's nothing scary going on there. And it was really sometime later that I put together that the flickering of the strobe lights reminded me of the flickering of that early motion picture that my father took with that camera. And, of course, there was nothing scary in the disco. Everyone else was having a good time. But I was feeling frightened, as though there was something threatening going on. Okay, so what's important about this? Well, obviously, it wouldn't damage my life if I were never anywhere with a strobe light. But if you had a rageaholic parent who yelled at you, and perhaps you heard the example last week of the couple where the woman had a rageaholic father, and when her husband, who was not a rageaholic, would raise his voice in an argument, she would immediately have the chemical dropped in her bloodstream that she experienced as a small child. If you had, if your house caught on fire, and maybe even a match would scare you. Well, this reminds me, I had a dog who you couldn't light a match in his presence. He was in another room. He was gone. So if you have a reaction today that is an overreaction, or it's a reaction you don't understand, it may very well be that it is because you had an early experience which taught you something which is now being reopened, re-triggered in the presence. So how do you alter that? Well, you recognize that what's going on is there is a stimulus. The brain fires a neuron. The neuron drops the chemical. So we can alter this by adding to the neuron firing, by adding a firing to it. So, for example, with my strobe light story, when I talk about that and when I think about that picture and I feel that little frisson of apprehension in my stomach, I say to myself, oh, yes, that's a neural firing. That's an old neural firing. That's just a chemical. And now I have added to the firing of the apprehension chemical, I have added the firing of a chemical that says, oh, it's okay, it's just a chemical. If you do that over time, you add to the neural firing, to the initial one, you add the second one. And I'm fond of saying these days that while we cannot delete old learnings, old neural firings, we can dilute them. And the way we dilute them is by adding to the neural firing, adding the recognition, this is just a chemical. So, let's say your boyfriend is not calling you. And when he doesn't call you, you feel despair or terror or rage, for that matter. Maybe that response goes back to a disappointment that was actually done to you by a parent or a sibling or a teacher or a friend early in life. And your brain learned that if somebody disappoints you, something really terrible is going to happen. And so this disappointment triggers the chemical in your bloodstream that says, oh my God, oh my God. If every time that happens, you say to yourself, oh yes, that's a neural firing. That's just a chemical in my bloodstream. I don't have to feel that way. If you do that every single time, over time, you will add to the neural firing. Recently, I had a conversation with a client in which he described that whenever he feels as though his lover is potentially going to leave him. He becomes despairing. It's so terrible that he can't even get out of bed. Well, of course, we found an early experience in his childhood when he was abandoned and when the consequences to him were terrible. So what he's doing now, whenever he gets that suspicion that his lover might leave him, is that he says to himself, ah, yes, that's that neuron firing. And I know it's just a chemical. And that recognition can, especially over time, if you really do it, dilute the feeling. So that now, while he has to run to find his lover, or call his lover on the phone, or chase his lover down, now he doesn't have to do the behavior that used to be triggered by this feeling, because he's diluted the feeling with a new neural firing, a new chemical in his bloodstream. He's changed his brain chemistry. And you can do it too. So if you have any questions about this, if you're wondering if a particular thing is just, is as I am describing, an old neural firing, an old learning of your brain, or whether it's really appropriate to the moment that you're in, if you're struggling with something and you want to ask me about it, please go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and that's LYNNESHOW, don't leave out the E, or you'll get another Lynn, and ask me, and I will respond. Okay, I think enough of the dense, serious, heavy stuff. Now let's move on to my interview with Carolyn Michael, and here it is.
In all the time that I know you, you have been, well, maybe one of the most versatile actors I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Oh, my God.
That's a very nice way to start out the interview. I like that.
Well, you've done everything.
Well, I started out in kindergarten raising my hands as a tulip.
As a tulip? So I started like this, you mean two hands up?
Two hands up. So I started out playing a tulip, and people applauded, and I really liked that. And then later on, I went to a girls' school, and I played the boys' roles because I was dark-haired and sort of a character actress even then. Wow. I played all the boys' roles. And so I had an early start of playing men and plants. And
variety.
And when I was 12, I played the mother in A Bird's Christmas Carol. I did drama. I went to a drama school, and I also took a lot of dance. And I was a very shy little girl, so it was a way that I could express myself in a controlled way. I found that I had an ability to do this, and it brought me attention. And I was felt more comfortable on stage than I did interacting in my real life, and a lot of performers say that. It's not, you know, people are always shocked that performers are shy, but
yeah.
Essentially there are a lot of us who are shy and then have these sort of other skills that we bring to the table.
I'm just curious, you're not shy now.
Well, I consider myself shy.
Do you?
Now. I consider myself a shy person who has developed good skills to compensate. So,
yeah.
So I don't, but inside I feel shy.
You still feel like,
even
though the behavior,
right.
You don't come across as a shy person.
Right. 400 years later.
Well, but it's interesting. I mean, are you really a shy person, or are you no longer a shy person, but you feel like what?
I think I am still a shy person. I don't think that it's just an old perception. I think that I feel that's who I really am. And I think it's based on the fact that I'm very, very vulnerable and very sensitive. And most people don't see that in me either.
Yeah.
Most people see my coping skills and my take charge skills those sorts of things. But I am extremely sensitive. And so there's a part of me that I protect.
You have to protect, right. And actually those skills...
And people would want me to, because they wouldn't want to see this, you know, sort of blubbering... sensitive person. Oh my God, what's wrong with her? So
I'm not sure that's true. But in fact, you certainly use that on stage.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
You let her.
She gets.
That's right.
Okay, you get to play now.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's great. So actually, I mean, you've done some extraordinary stuff with yourself. I mean, you have become able to do a whole range of behaviors whenever they're appropriate.
Well, that's of course the joy of being an actor is that you get to experience all facets of being a human.
Right.
When I was a little girl, they took me to symphonies and plays, and I loved it. I loved it from the very second I first saw Mary Martin fly across the stage. I went, oh.
Okay, so from that first moment, did you always want to do this? Was there something else you wanted to do?
I never wanted to do anything. So at one point, I thought maybe I'd dance, because as a child, I danced. But somewhere deep inside, I don't think even on a conscious level, but unconsciously, I knew that I wasn't ever going to be good enough. I don't have much extension, and I have flat feet, and I sort of didn't have
the body for it.
I was like great from the waist up. I knew that I would never be good. I would never be as good as you need to be. So I easily transitioned out of that desire and kept wanting to be an actor. And so I went to Boston University, and then I went to New York and studied some more, and you know, knocked around New York trying to get little off Broadway jobs and tried to knock on doors. And you know, I was putting my picture and resume under agents' doors. You couldn't even like see them. You would have to walk around to these big buildings and shove your picture and resume under the door. It was so humiliating and terrible. And I mean, I remember once I went to a cattle call for some show like No Net kind of thing, where you had to dress up in, you know, sort of little 20s things and tap, and I thought, oh, I'll dress like this, and I did. And of course I went there, and there were 400 young girls, cute young girls like myself.
Dressed like this.
Dressed like that. And I got lucky, and I did a bunch of summer stock, and then I started to get little jobs in dinner theaters. And in those days, dinner theater was really the training ground, mm-hmm. because you really could go from theater to theater and do good work, and I joined the union by that time, and so I was able to sort of learn and grow. And then I worked for, I've vacationed here in Sarasota, Florida I had vacationed here with my parents when I was a young girl, and then they bought a house here when I was a young girl, and so I would come back and forth from New York to here. Ultimately, I met Bob Turoff, who runs Golden Apple Dinner Theater, and he gave me a job in Butterflies Are Free and George M. And I think my first show was, you know, I Can't Hear You When the Water's Running, and then Mary Mary with him. So I did those four shows in one season for him, and was so happy to be in this environment and working. And I kept going back and forth between California and New York and here, and California and New York and here, and working, and you know. And then around, I don't know, several years later, Bob Turoff gave me an opportunity to direct.
Am I hearing that you wound up more and more in Sarasota? Is that what happened?
That's what happened. And so I sort of made a passive move here, because I kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And then ultimately, I just sort of never left. And I was having all these opportunities, both directing and acting. And so I stayed. It was the best thing I could have done for myself. Without even making it a conscious decision, I sort of followed my heart, as it were. Mm-hmm. And it was...
Or your feet.
My feet, yeah. Yeah. Or the jobs, as
yeah,
it were.
Yeah, right.
So I love living in Sarasota. I think it's a beautiful place to live, and it's a terrific arts community. And right now I'm directing... I just finished my 17th season at the Oslo Theater, and I've worked at Florida Studio Theater a lot. Last summer I did a one-person play where I played Ann Landers. And now I'm directing for the West Coast Black Theater Troupe. A play opens this tonight as we speak, Aunt Rudell's Family Reunion. Mm-hmm. And I'm directing a play reading in Florida Studio Theater's new play festival next week. And then I'm taking the summer off because I really want a break. And then I'm coming back to be in the Oslo Repertory Company, which is something that when I was a kid, I used to go to the Oslo and watch the plays, and I thought, someday I want to be good enough to be able to be on that stage and do that. And so I really didn't even know really consciously that it was, I mean, I thought that, but I also thought, well, I want to be a big TV star too. But, you know, you think that too. But I think that I did fulfill my own personal dream about being able to be here and have a life as a theater artist and have a life.
Yeah.
And challenge myself with all these different roles. So it's I've had tremendous opportunities, and it's been a joy and a blessing. And then I met my wonderful husband.
Yes.
I just got married 7 years ago, so, and I'm no spring chicken. So,
you waited a long time to get married.
I did wait a long time to get married.
I stopped the interview there. If you want to hear the whole interview with Carolyn, and in fact, the whole interview with Howard, and in fact, the whole interview with the two of them, you can find that on my website. Again, that's thelinshow.com. And there's a place to click on podcasts. And if you run back, you'll see where I interviewed them, and you can listen to the whole interview. But I stopped Carolyn's interview there, because later you will hear the two of them together. And now I'm going to play the review, Sharon's review, of The Imaginary Invalid.
This is Sharon Leslie, and I am reviewing The Imaginary Invalid, currently playing at the Oslo Repertory Theatre. Molière meets Monty Python in the Oslo Repertory Theatre's visually stunning production of The Imaginary Invalid. Spectacle and over-the-top costumes keep the eyes stimulated. Argon, the title character, is obsessed with the physical. He is easy prey to the perpetual prescriptions of enemas to purge his system of whatever appears to be ailing him that day, and to the sexual manipulations of his second wife, Baleen. His imagined illnesses propel him to arrange the marriage of his daughter Angélique to Claude D'Aria, the nephew of his doctor, Pergian. Complications arise since Angélique has fallen in love with the handsome Cléante. Meanwhile, stepmother Baleen connives to put Angélique in a convent and take control of her husband's estate. The only sane mind amidst all this hullabaloo is Toinette, the maid. As Toinette, Carolyn Michael brings humanity and humor to this production. Her rendering of the maid while working in this camp style never lost its human touch and is rewarded with the most laughs in the production. The visuals are an excellent reason to go see this production. The set designed by Julie Galen displays the invalid study in exaggerated angles and a dark burnt coral that displays the color palette of the costumes beautifully. The costumes give a nod to the 1670 time period, but have a modern flavor. The noble ladies wear wide-hipped farthingale skirts, but only to the knee. Argan the invalid lives in a terrycloth bathrobe. The evil stepmother, Baleen, enters, and get this, colorful pantaloons with a corseted top, goth-style high-heeled boots, and a black lace cape of devilish design. By the way, whenever her name is mentioned, thunder is heard. The most fun costume was worn by Claude D'Aria. It molted feathers across the stage. Toinette, the maid, was richly attired in the standard French-made black and white with lace accents. If you like Monty Python-style comedy, you will love this production. The play runs until March the first.
So if you're into farce or just into great performances, hurry on out to the Oslo Theater. You only have a few days to catch it. And now I'm going to play a piece of the interview that I did with Howard Millman, who, as I have said before, is the director of Visiting Mr. Green. And as with Carolyn's interview, I'm only playing a little piece of it. So it may sound like it started in the middle, and it may very well have. Anyway, here's Howard.
Always loved the theater and the movies, and secretly desired to do it, and was petrified to tell my parents that's what I wanted to do.
So you're the oldest boy in a Jewish family?
I am the oldest boy in a Jewish family. I'm the prince.
You're the prince.
I'm the prince.
I know you are. Yeah. But still, shouldn't you be a dentist or something?
Well, it's interesting. I told my father that, I guess it was at the end of my freshman year in college, that I was going to switch from pre-law to the theater.
Oh, my God.
He said, what kind of shingle can you hang outside your door?
Yeah.
And I justified it by saying, don't worry, I'll teach.
Yeah.
He didn't understand what it meant for me to go on to advanced degrees. He had no idea of that. He thought, you go to college, you get out and you go to work. And then I went to Florida State University in 1958 to take my doctorate at the urging of Dick Fallon, who had been my teacher in undergraduate school and who was my mentor. And he said, I've just gotten this job at Florida State University. Why don't you come and take your doctorate, which I did. Dick Fallon, they had then started the theater on a year-round basis in 1966. In 1968, he asked me to come and be the managing director at the Oslo Theater. And I said, I will, under one condition, that I direct plays, because managing directors don't direct.
They manage money.
They manage money. So I did that. From 1968 to 1980, I directed 14 plays in that old Oslo Theater. Nationally, the regional theater movement was just beginning to grow. And the problem was that I was very, very well known among my peers as a hot manager. And I didn't want to be a hot manager.
Yeah.
You know, I had 14 years of artistic work behind me, and I knew I had to leave to do that. To make a long story short, I wound up after a year and a half at the Pittsburgh Public Theater, which didn't work out for me. I wound up taking over a storefront theater in Rochester, New York in 1982. Called Jiva Theater, Genesee Valley Arts Foundation, Jiva Theater. And that was 1982, and by March of 1985, I opened a brand new 500-seat theater with 10,000 subscribers. So you can see from taking over the Oslo the first time when we were $250,000 in debt in 1968, and then going to Jiva and building that up, the kind of course my career took, which was building and saving theaters. You know, and those challenges were hugely exciting to me, you know, and I was fearless. I was always fearless with other people's money, never with my own. And then in 1995, after having been at Jiva for 14 years, the Oslo got into serious, serious trouble. And Brad Wallace, who had been an actor with the company for years and years and years, these 38 years with the company, called me and said, would you come back? And I said, well, in the proper conditions, I would come back. And he said, well, what are those? And I laid it out. You know, I wanted full charge. I didn't want to have to deal with it. And I wanted to be back on the university payroll, which I was. And so I sent my resume to him. Interesting story. He took it to Carolyn. She was on the board.
Wow.
Now, we knew each other, but we knew each other as professional colleagues.
Right.
You know, I knew who she was. I knew her parents. Even though they were gone, I knew her parents very well because they were major supporters of the theater back in the 60s and the 70s. And so she took it around because I was gone for 15 years. So many of the board members did not know who I was. So many people in town knew who I was, and so many board members did not know who I was.
Right.
And she said, this is the guy you want to hire. And they went through, I guess, 150 names and wound up with me.
So she got herself a husband.
She got herself a husband. Exactly.
Very smart.
Exactly. Actually, it wasn't that simple.
No, it never is.
No, it wasn't.
No, it never is.
It wasn't. And that's how I came back in 95 when we were $2 million in debt and closing our doors and all of that. And
you did it again.
Well, it was, you know, I knew if I had enough time it would be okay. The question was time. But I had an alternative plan. See, I knew that I was going to retire in Sarasota.
Very clever of you.
I knew that.
Mm-hmm. So you worked your way back, kind of.
So I thought, if it goes, I'm here.
That's right. And if it doesn't, you're here.
If it doesn't, I'm here. Either way.
Yeah.
So 11 or 12 years later, I finally retired. You know?
And here you are.
And here I am.
But I know you're not retired.
I am retired from running a company. I will never do that again.
Yeah.
I never realized. I loved every moment. All my career, I loved every moment of what I did. But the day I retired, we took a month-long cruise, and I came back, and I realized when I came back and we walked through these doors and I got up the next morning that every day had been stress.
Yes.
Every day.
Yeah.
And suddenly...
Free.
You know.
Free at last.
All I became was the honeydew man, and that was good. But I am, you know, freelance directing, and have been doing that steadily and enjoying it and continue to do it. And we travel in the summertime, and, you know, life is good. I don't think I can totally retire from doing what I love, which is directing plays.
Yeah.
I
you don't have to.
No.
Wrap up. Is there anything that you would want to say about yourself, about the theater? About
if anyone could be in the place in life that I am right now, they would be extremely content.
It's very lovely. That's very
lovely. I would wish on anyone the place that I am in right now.
Me too.
With a beautiful marriage and a great life and still active and still doing what I want.
A history you're proud of and a present that you love.
A history I'm proud of, exactly. And a present that I'm absolutely relishing. So.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you.
I love playing that. It's so wonderful to hear true happiness, true contentment, true having found the place you want to be. So, without saying very much more about that, except that I hope you're wanting to hear the interview with the two of them, as they have both spoken about their marriage, which came to both of them rather late in life. But first, here's Sharon's review of Visiting Mr. Green.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie, and today I'm doing a review of Visiting Mr. Green. How is it that a play that has been translated into 22 languages and performed in 33 different countries, sometimes winning best play awards in those countries, remains relatively unknown? Well, such is the case of Visiting Mr. Green, written by Jeff Baron. This two-person play at the historic Oslo happily reunites veteran actor David Howard in the role of the 85-year-old Mr. Green with director Howard Mildman, who was the Oslo Repertory Theatre's former artistic director. Playing the 29-year-old Ross Gardner, who must visit Mr. Green, is Craig Swartz. Since I got to hear one of those talk-back sessions after seeing a matinee, I can tell you that this trio has done three separate productions of the play. Why do I need to mention this when doing a review? Well, because we, the audience, benefit. This trio already knows what works and how to make it work. I suggest you go and see three marvelous theater artists at their best. Visiting Mr. Green begins as a light-hearted comedy. Because of a car accident where he nearly hit Mr. Green, Ross Gardner is ordered to do community service and visit the cantankerous and forgetful widower. As the visits proceed, we learn about the characters as they learn about each other. Both men have had to deal with discrimination and prejudice. Both men have issues with their families that are unresolved. What gets revealed in the course of the play is surprising, and I'm not going to tell you what happens and spoil that surprise, except that, as in life, sometimes it takes a stranger to bring understanding to those issues. The reason Visiting Mr. Green is loved around the world is that it is felt personally and relates to all of us in some way or other. Director Mildman has crafted the action in a way that feels human and natural. The motivations are clear, and the scene work brings out the humor, the emotions, and the various levels of intensity. Mildman is at home directing this kind of play. As for the two actors, David Howard portrays Mr. Green with a joy in his craft and emotional confidence. Howard is marvelous to watch, both funny and touching. Craig Swartz brings a youthful energy and bounce to Ross Gardner. He shows both the compassion and confusion of a younger person dealing with the problems of aging. How the two actors work together and feed off each other is charming and engaging. Don't wait to get tickets. Visiting Mr. Green runs only until March 1st.
Okay, I don't know about you, but I'm running right out to get tickets and see Visiting Mr. Green. Sharon also reviewed several other plays that are going to be at the Oslo later in the spring, and I will be playing those reviews next month and the month after that, and hopefully I will be doing interviews with people who are connected to the productions. But now I'm going to play just a portion of the delightful interview that I did with Carolyn Michael and her husband, Howard Mildman.
You waited a long time to get married.
Yes, I did.
So is your relationship to your work different because there's now somebody who shares that with you.
My relationship to my work is different because I have a fuller life now. Mm-hmm. And so my relationship to my work is different. I've also worked so much and that have done it that much more that my relationship to my work is different as well.
Do you mean you're working more now than you did before, or you worked more before than you are now?
I've worked a lot all the time.
Yeah.
I've worked a lot all the time.
I think she's working with more confidence now that she's done it so much.
Ah. Yeah.
That's what I think.
And do you bounce it? I mean, you're not always working with Howard, so do you talk to him about the other work you're doing?
Yes.
Yes.
And you know what I do?
Mm-hmm.
I say, uh-huh.
Yeah, I was going to say, he'd rather I didn't, but I do.
She has to air it. All women have to air it, you know.
Oh,
I,
no, yeah.
I have finally learned that all the men have to do is say, oh, uh-huh. We're very good together. Mm-hmm. We really are. I can read her eyes when I see that she's not happy with a suggestion I've given her. I can read her eyes when I see she's ecstatic with a suggestion I've given her.
Yeah.
I can read her eyes when I see she's not sure that what I've given her is the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we work very well together. The difference between us is when we come home.
Yeah.
Because I want to shut it all down. And she doesn't.
I still process when I'm home.
It's a very good thing that she shares her anxieties.
Yes. Even if you're just a sounding board for it.
Exactly right.
Yes.
Exactly right.
The arts is an unstable thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may or you may not have work, you may or you may not do good work, you may or may not be appreciated for the work you do, however good it is. You're always at the mercy of something outside yourself. I mean, there's just all of these places that are in which you're vulnerable. And so to have a spouse who understands that, it seems to me, is potentially incredibly comforting and supportive, but not all couples who are in the arts can do that for each other.
Well, that's true. I think it's important that we also we don't compete with each other.
Yes.
So there is that issue that we can be totally supportive of each other. There is no competition. And it's later in our lives,
yeah,
too. So we're not young. So you bring to your work, your creative work, and your relationship a different perspective, because you're in a different part of your life and you've just lived that many more years where you have accumulated experience that can bring you to this place. No matter what my accumulated experience is, I always wake up at midnight and go, I'm going to suck in this play. So there seems to be a point where my accumulated experience has no impact.
So I want to ask about that, two things about that. One, is it different for you? I mean, I'm assuming that you used to get up in the middle of the night and say to yourself, I'm going to suck in this play.
Mm-hmm.
And now, when you get up and you say, I'm going to suck in this play, there is someone else there. Is it different?
It's an interesting question.
That is an interesting question. Yes, I guess it is different because I get to say it and have somebody to say it to in the middle of the night.
You got to say it out loud.
I used to have to call. Yeah, I get to say it out loud. I used to have to call California. They're the only ones awake in the middle of the night.
So did you?
What?
Call people?
I did, but I didn't. I don't think I ever said I'm going to suck in this play. I think I would just call to
chat.
And that would be a way to distract me from my own personal self-doubt. That's true.
I'm going to suck in this play.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way she's going to suck in the play, even if I haven't seen it. You know, I know that's just her inner fears, because Carolyn is so good and so experienced that she will, you know, find a way to come out with a sparkling performance. But it's the absolute insecurity of the performer. I mean, that's just what it is. So when she says that, it really has nothing to do, I think, with the fact that she does have a lot of experience. She knows she can. She's not in a panic mode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're younger, you get into a panic mode. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? I don't know how to get out of this. I'm confident that she knows that she'll get out.
No, you know, when I was younger, I was fearless, and I thought that I was terrific, and anything I did was terrific. So it was really
the other way around.
Now I'm aware of what a complex process it is, and what my own personal demands of myself are in terms of wanting excellence as opposed to good enough. It's the proverbial artist facing the blank canvas.
It's the nature of the beast. If I've directed a play before, I don't go into the first rehearsal with the apprehensions that I have when I direct a play that I've not done before. Mm-hmm. And I don't care how many years it's been. I walk into rehearsal the first day and I say to myself very quietly, today they're going to find me out. You know, today they're going to find me out. Yeah. I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
It's my own expectation in pursuit of excellence that promotes me to say, I'm going to suck in this play.
She gets very, very upset with me when, if I'm directing, or even if I went, go to see a preview of a show that I haven't directed, and we're driving home, and she says, you got any notes for me? And I say, no. She gets very upset because I have to have notes for her. She's got to get better. I have to have notes for her.
Wow.
You know, and that's what's going on when I know that she's doing a wonderful job, and I don't want to gild the lily. You know, I don't want to mess with it.
So let me ask you here. Do you think that he's telling you the truth when he says, I don't have any notes for you? It's perfect. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to do anything with it. Do you think he's not telling you the truth?
I think he's not telling me the truth. But I think that, I don't think he's telling me the whole truth. I think that there's probably a couple of things he'd like to tell me, but he feels it's more important for me to have confidence in what I'm
doing.
We're
going to have an argument right now. Because that's not true.
Really?
She has, at times, I have given her good notes. When I have no notes, it means I have no notes.
It's real interesting. I mean, because this is much more about you, I think, than it does about him.
Yes,
you know that
it does.
That you can't even imagine that he doesn't have song notes for you, right?
Right.
And it's the same thing that you were talking about before, which is this, you know, good, better, best, never let it rest until my good is better and my better is the best, and you never get there.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I've always said that if I ever gave a perfect performance where I was absolutely in the moment and present for every single moment of the play, I would retire, because that's sort of what you aim for.
I look at it another way.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it as it's fleeting and it's okay. You know, I've just finished doing a piece, Visiting Mr. Green. I'm going to be doing it again at the Oslo next January. For me, it was, and I've done the play before, twice before. This was the third time. Mm-hmm. And for me,
you've directed it. This is the third time you've directed it.
For me, the opening night was perfection.
Wow.
Except for one blown like you. For me, the opening night was perfection in terms of the work that the two actors did.
Wow.
And if I say to myself, I've got to recreate that again next time, I will kill myself.
Yes, yes.
I've just got to say, this was the moment. And if it happens again, fine. If it doesn't happen again, it will still be fine.
Yeah, that's so lovely.
It's elusive. Performance is elusive.
Well, that's of course what makes live performance so exciting, is that it is elusive. And, you know, the film, you can capture that moment and therefore repeat it again and again, because they would edit that moment into the piece. Whereas live theater, if you weren't in that audience that night,
You didn't see that.
You will see a wonderful performance. You will see something else. You'll see the same play and also wonderful, but maybe not that exact chemistry of that particular evening. That's the thrill of live theater and the terror of it as well. But we always must remind ourselves that it is not brain surgery. It is not life and death. It is only facing public humiliation.
It's only a play. Carolyn's favorite statement is about opening night.
Mm-hmm.
All I want to do is escape public humiliation. That's it.
Right. Well, you've been successful so far.
More or less, yes. Knock wood.
She's come out of opening night saying I was not at my best. You know, we all
do
that.
We all do that. I don't think anybody's really at their best opening nights. Very rarely does that happen unless you've done a play so many times that it's in your bones, and so it's not really an opening night. It's an opening night several productions down the line. I think that there's a lot of adrenaline going on, and there's a lot of, you know, excitement, and you really are better later on in the run when you relax into the play.
We have two previews here. Some theaters, right, they only have one preview before opening night. Broadway, they have a month of previews so that they can settle into it and, and, and have it right.
Well, and get used to doing it in front of an audience.
Oh, yeah.
Right, the audience is your scene partner. So, yeah, it's sort of cruel and unusual punishment to only have two previews and then to go in front of an audience, especially in a comedy. Death is easy and comedy is hard because of the timing. You have to make real choices and also make choices that are potentially laugh-producing. So it's very tricky. It's a little high-wire balancing act, but all you can do is release yourself to the material and hope that it all, you know, that all the rehearsal turns out okay. And listen for the audience. Connect yourself with what the audience, live audience tells you so much of where a play lives and why we perform the plays and don't just read them. Howard and I have both been very, very blessed to have lived a life of love and art.
I agree. It's a good place to
She's
start.
She's much more articulate than I am.
And on that sweet note, we come to the end of this show. And I get to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do, my IT guru guy, who makes sure that the show sounds as good as it possibly can sound and is there at my back when I can't do something or I have forgotten how to do something that I do know how to do. Josh either shows up or he calls me and walks me through it. There's a mindset for this which I don't seem to be able to develop, but fortunately for me, there is Josh Hackney. And if you have questions, needs, requirements that have to do with recording or electronics or computer, you want Josh at your back as well. So again, you can go up on my website, thelinshow.com, click on Contact Me, say I need Josh, and I will get him for you. But now I am hoping that this show provided you with something that you can use, something that entertained you or stimulated you, something that makes you want to come back next week, because next week at 1 o'clock on Tuesday Eastern Standard Time and 3 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday, I will be here, and I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. Chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go.
gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got